portal back to childhood. Chinese porcelains, lighted landscape paintings, silk-shaded lamps burning low. Everything exactly as when Mr. Barber had opened the door to me the night my mother died. "No, no," said Platt, when by habit I walked toward the bull's-eye mirror and through to the living room. "Back here." He was heading to the rear of the apartment. "We're very informal now. Mommy usually sees people back here, if she sees anybody at all." Back in the day, I had never been anywhere near Mrs. Barber's inner sanctum, but as we approached, the smell of her perfume, unmistakable, white blossoms with a powdery strangeness at the heart, was like a blown curtain over an open window. "She doesn't go out the way she once did," Platt was saying quietly. "None of these big dinners and events. Maybe once a week she'll have someone over for tea or go to dinner with a friend, but that's it." Platt knocked. He listened. "Mommy?" he called, and, at the indistinct reply, opened the door a crack. "I've got a guest for you. You'll never guess who I found on the street." It was an enormous room, done up in an old ladyish 1980s peach. Directly off the entrance was a seating area with a sofa and slipper chairs, lots of knickknacks, needlepoint cushions, 9 or 10 old master drawings, The Flight into Egypt, Jacob and the Angel, circle of Rembrandt mostly, though there was a tiny pen and brown ink of Christ washing the feet of St. Peter, which was so deftly done, the weary slump and drape of Christ's back, the blank, complicated sadness on St. Peter's face, that it might have been from Rembrandt's own hand. I leaned forward for a closer look, and on the far side of the room, a lamp with a pagoda-shaped shade popped on.
"Theo?"
I heard her say, and there she was, propped on piles of pillows in an outlandishly large bed.
"You? I can't believe it," she said, holding out her arms to me. "You're all grown up. Where in the world have you been? Are you in the city now?"
"Yes. I've been back for a while now. You look wonderful," I added dutifully, though she didn't.
"And you,"
she put both hands over mine.
"How handsome you are. I'm quite overcome."
She looked both older and younger than I remembered. Very pale, no lipstick, lines at the corner of her eyes, but her skin still white and smooth. Her silver blonde hair, had it always been quite that silver, or had she gone gray? Fell loose and uncombed about her shoulders. She was wearing half-moon glasses and a satin bed jacket pinned with a huge diamond brooch in the shape of a snowflake.
"And here you find me, in my bed, with my needlework, like an old sailor's widow," she said, gesturing at the unfinished needlepoint canvas across her knees.
A pair of tiny dogs, Yorkshire terriers, were asleep on a pale cashmere throw at her feet, and the smaller of the two, spotting me, sprang up and began to bark furiously. Uneasily, I smiled as she tried to quiet him. The other dog had set up a racket as well, and looked around. The bed was modern, king-sized, with a fabric-covered headboard, but she had a lot of interesting old things back there that I wouldn't have known to pay attention to when I was a kid. Clearly, it was the Sargasso Sea of the apartment, where objects banished from the carefully decorated public rooms washed up. Mismatched end tables, Asian bric-a-brac, a knockout collection of silver table bells, a mahogany games table that from where I stood looked like it might be Duncan Fife, and atop it, among cheap cloisonné ashtrays and endless coasters, a taxidermied cardinal, moth-eaten, fragile, feathers faded to rust, its head cocked sharply and its eye a dusty black bead of horror.
"Tingling. Shh, please be quiet. I can't bear it." "This is Tingling," said Mrs. Barber, catching the struggling dog up in her arms. "He's the naughty one, aren't you, darling? Never a moment's peace. And the other, with the pink ribbon, is Clementine." "Platt," she called over the barking. "Platt, we could take him in the kitchen." He's really a bit of a nuisance with guests, she said to me. I ought to have a trainer in.
While Mrs. Barber rolled up her needlework and put it in an oval basket with a piece of scrimshaw set in the lid, I sat down in the armchair by her bed. The upholstery was worn, and the subdued stripe was familiar to me, a former living room chair exiled to the bedroom, the same chair I'd found my mother sitting in when she'd come to the barber's many years ago to pick me up after a sleepover. I drew a finger over the cloth. All at once, I saw my mother standing to greet me, in the bright green peacoat she'd been wearing that day, fashionable enough that people were always stopping her on the street to ask her where she got it, yet all wrong for the barber's house.
Theo, said Mrs. Barber, would you like something to drink? A cup of tea? Or something stronger?
No, thank you. She patted the brocade coverlet of the bed.
Come sit next to me, please. I want to be able to see you.
At her tone, at once intimate and formal, a terrible sadness came over me, and when we looked at each other, it seemed that the whole past was redefined and brought into focus by this moment, clear as glass. A complexity of stillness that was rainy afternoons in spring, a dark chair in the hallway, the light as air touch of her hand on the back of my head.
I'm so glad you came.
Mrs. Barber, I said, moving to the bed, sitting down gingerly with one hip.
My God, I can't believe it.
I didn't find out till just now.
I'm so sorry.
She pressed her lips together like a child trying not to cry.
Yes,
she said.
Well.
And there issued between us an awful and seemingly unbreakable silence. I'm so sorry, I repeated, more urgently, aware just how clumsy I sounded, as if by speaking more loudly I might convey my acuity of sorrow. Unhappily, she blinked, and, not knowing what to do, I reached out and put my hand on top of hers, and we sat for an uncomfortably long time. In the end, it was she who spoke first.
At any rate.
Resolutely, she dashed a tear from her eye while I flailed about for something to say.
He had mentioned you, not 3 days before he died. He was engaged to be married, to a Japanese girl.
No kidding.
Really?
Sad as I was, I couldn't help smiling a little. Andy had chosen Japanese as his second language, precisely because he had such a thing for fan service Miko and slutty manga girls in sailor uniform. Japanese from Japan?
Indeed. Tiny little thing, with a squeaky voice and a pocketbook shaped like a stuffed animal. Oh, yes, I met her, she said with a raised eyebrow. Andy translating over tea sandwiches at the Pierre. She was at the funeral, of course. The girl, her name was Miyako. Well, different cultures and all that. But it's true what they say about the Japanese being undemonstrative.
The little dog, Clementine, had crawled up to curl around Mrs. Barber's shoulder like a fur collar.
I have to admit, I'm thinking of getting a third, she said, reaching over to stroke her. What do you think?
I don't know, I said, disconcerted. It was extremely unlike Mrs. Barber to solicit opinions from anyone at all on any subject, certainly not from me.
I must say, they've been an enormous comfort, the pair of them. My old friend, Maria Mercedes de la Pereira, turned up with them a week after the funeral. Quite unexpected. Two pups in a basket with ribbons on. And I have to say, I wasn't sure at first, but actually I don't think I've ever received a more thoughtful gift. We could never have dogs before because of Andy. He was so terribly allergic, you remember?
I do. Platt, still in his tweed gamekeeper's jacket, with big sagged-out pockets for dead birds and shotgun shells, had come back in. He pulled up a chair.
So,
Mommy, he said, biting his lower lip.
So, Platypus.
A formal silence.
Good day at work?
Great. He nodded, as if trying to reassure himself of the fact.
Yeah, really, really busy.
I'm so glad to hear it.
New books, but one on the Congress of Vienna.
Another one?
She turned to me.
And you, Theo?
Sorry?
I'd been looking at the Scrimshaw, a whaling ship, set in the lid of her sewing basket, and thinking of poor Andy. Black water, salt in his throat, nausea and flailing, the horror and cruelty of dying in his most hated element.
The problem essentially is that I despise boats.
Tell me, what are you doing with yourself these days?
Dealing antiques. American furniture, mostly.
No.
She was rapturous.
But how perfect.
Yes, down in the village. I run the shop and manage the sales end. My partner, it was still so new I wasn't used to saying it. My partner in the business, James Hobart, he's the craftsman, takes care of restorations. You should come down and visit sometime.
Oh, delicious. Antiques.
She sighed.
Well, you know how I love old things. I wish my children had shown an interest. I'd always hoped at least one of them would.
Well, there's always Kitsy, said Platt.
It's curious, Mrs. Barber continued, as if she hadn't heard this. Not one of my children had an artistic bone in their bodies. Isn't that extraordinary? Little Philistines, all four of them.
Oh, please, I said in as playful a tone as I could manage. I remember Toddie and Kitsy with all those piano lessons, Andy with his Suzuki violin. She made a dismissive gesture.
Oh, you know what I mean. None of my children have any visual sense. No appreciation whatever for painting or interiors or any of that. Now,
again she took my hand,
when you were a child, I used to catch you in the hallway studying my paintings. You'd always go straight to the very best ones. The Frederick Church landscape, my FitzHenry Lane and my Raphael Peel, or the John Singleton Copley. You know, the oval portrait, the tiny one, girl in the bonnet.
That was a Copley?
Indeed. And I saw you with the little Rembrandt just now.
So it is Rembrandt, then?
Yes. Only the one, the washing of the feet. The rest are all school of. My own children have lived with these drawings their whole lives and never displayed the slightest particle of interest. Isn't that right, Platt?
I like to think that some of us have excelled at other things. I cleared my throat. You know, I really did just stop in to say hello, I said. It's wonderful to see you. To see you both. Turning to include Platt in this. I wish it were under happier circumstances.
Will you stay and have dinner?
I'm sorry, I said, feeling cornered. I can't. Not tonight. But I did want to run up for a minute and see you.
Then will you come back for dinner?
Or lunch, or drinks? She laughed.
Or whatever you will.
Dinner, sure. She held up her cheek for a kiss, as she had never done when I was a child, not even with her own children.
How lovely to have you here again, she said, catching my hand and pressing it to her face. Like old times.
4. On my way out the door, Platt threw out some kind of weird handshake, part gang member, part fraternity boy, part international sign language, that I wasn't sure how to return. In confusion, I withdrew my hand and, not knowing what else to do, bumped fists with him, feeling stupid.
So, hey, glad we ran into each other, I said in the awkward silence. Give me a call. About dinner? Oh, yes. We'll probably eat in, if that's all right. Mommy really doesn't like to go out that much.
He dug his hands into the pockets of his jacket. Then, shockingly, I've seen a good bit of your old friend Cable lately. Bit more than I care to, actually. He'll be interested to know I've seen you.
Tom Cable?
I laughed incredulously, although it wasn't much of a laugh. The bad old memory of how we'd been suspended from school together and how he'd blown me off when my mother died still made me uneasy.
You're in touch with him?
I said, when Platt didn't respond.
I haven't thought of Tom in years.
Platt smirked.
I have to admit, back in the day, I thought it was weird that any friend of that kid's would put up with a drip like Andy, he said, quietly, slouching back against the doorframe. Not that I minded. God knows Andy needed somebody to take him out and
get him stoned or something. Andrip. Android. One nut. Pimple face. SpongeBob shit pants.
No,
said Platt casually, misreading my blank stare. I thought you were into that. Cable was certainly quite the little pothead in his day. That must have been after I left.
Well, maybe.
Platt looked at me in a way I wasn't sure I liked.
Mommy certainly thought butter wouldn't melt in your mouth,
but I knew you were pals with Cable. And Cable was a little thief. Sharply, in a way that brought the old, unpleasant Platt ringing back, he laughed.
I told Kitsy and Toddy to keep their rooms locked when you were here, so you wouldn't steal anything.
That's what all that was about? I had not thought of the piggy bank incident in years.
Well, I mean, Cable.
He glanced at the ceiling.
See, I used to date Tom's sister Joey. Holy hell, she was a piece of work too.
Right. I remembered all too well Joey Cable, 16 and stacked, brushing by 12-year-old me in the hallway of the Hamptons house, in tiny t-shirt and black thong panties.
Sloppy Joe. What an ass she had on her. Remember how she used to parade around naked by the hot tub out there? Anyway, Cable, out in the Hamptons at Daddy's club, he got caught rifling lockers in the men's changing rooms. Couldn't have been more than 12 or 13. That was after you left, huh?
Must have been.
That sort of thing happened at several clubs out there. Like, during big tournaments and stuff. He'd sneak into the locker room and steal whatever he could get his hands on. Then, maybe college by then. Oh, darn, where was it? Not Maidstone, but... Anyway, Cable had a summer job in the clubhouse, helping out at the bar, ferrying home old folks to Blotto to drive. Personable guy. Good talker. Well, you know. He'd get the old fellows talking about their war stories or whatever. Light their cigarettes, laugh at their jokes. Except sometimes he'd help the old fellows up to the door, and the next day their wallets would be missing.
Well, I haven't laid eyes on him in years, I said curtly. I didn't like the tone Platt had taken. What's he doing now, anyway?
Well, you know. Up to his old tricks. As a matter of fact, he sees my sister from time to time, though I certainly wish I could put a stop to that. At any rate, he said, on a slightly altered note, here I am, keeping you. I can't wait to tell Kitsy and Toddy I've seen you. Todd especially. You made quite an impression on him. He speaks of you all the time. He'll be in town next weekend, and I know he'll want to see you.
5. Instead of taking a cab, I walked to clear my head. It was a clean, damp spring day, storm clouds pierced with bars of light and office workers milling in the crosswalks. But spring in New York was always a poisoned time for me, a seasonal echo of my mother's death blowing in with the daffodils, budding trees and blood splashes, a thin spray of hallucination and horror.
Neat. Fun.
As Zandra might have said. With the news about Andy, it was like someone had thrown an X-ray switch and reversed everything into photographic negative, so that even with the daffodils and the dog walkers and the traffic cops whistling on the corners, death was all I saw. Sidewalks teeming with dead. Cadavers pouring off the buses and hurrying home from work. Nothing left of any of them in 100 years except tooth fillings and pacemakers, and maybe a few scraps of cloth and bone. It was unthinkable. I thought of calling Andy a million times, and it was only embarrassment that had kept me from it. It was true that I didn't keep up with anyone from the old days, but I did bump into someone from our school every now and again, and our old schoolmate Martina Lichtblau, with whom the year before I had had a brief and unsatisfying affair, a total of 3 stealthy fucks on a fold-out sofa. Martina Lichtblau had spoken of him. Andy's in Massachusetts now. Are you still in touch with Andy?
Oh, yeah. Just as humongous a geek as ever, except he plays it up so much now it's almost like kind of retro and cool. Coke bottle glasses, orange corduroys, and a haircut like Darth Vader's helmet.
Wow, Andy, I thought, shaking my head fondly, reaching over Martina's bare shoulder for one of her cigarettes. I had thought then how good it would be to see him.
Too bad he wasn't in New York. Maybe I'd call him sometime over the holidays, when he was home. Only I hadn't. I wasn't on Facebook for reasons of paranoia, and seldom looked at the news. But still, I couldn't imagine how I hadn't heard, except that in recent weeks I'd been worried about the shop, to the point I thought of little else. Not that we had worries financially. We'd been pulling in money almost literally hand over fist, so much money that Hobie, crediting me for his salvation, he'd been on the verge of bankruptcy, had insisted on making me partner, which I hadn't been all that keen on given the circumstances. But my efforts to put him off had only made him more determined that I should share in the profits. The more I tried to brush off his offer, the more persistent he grew, with typical generosity. He attributed my reticence to modesty, although in fact my real fear was that a partnership would shed a certain official light on unofficial goings-on in the shop, goings-on that would shock poor Hobie to the soles of his John Lobb shoes, if he knew, which he didn't. For I'd intentionally sold a fake to a client, and the client had figured it out and was kicking up a fuss. I didn't mind giving the money back. In fact, the only thing to do was to buy the piece back at a loss. In the past, this had worked for me well. I sold heavily altered or outright reconstructed pieces as original. If, out of the dim light of Hobart and Blackwell, the collector got the piece home and noticed something amiss, "Always carry a pocket light with you," Hobie had counseled me early in the game. "There's a reason so many antique shops are dark." Then I, grieved at the mix-up, while stalwart in my conviction that the piece was genuine, gallantly offered to buy it back at 10% more than the collector had paid, under the conditions and terms of an ordinary sale. This made me look like a good guy, confident in the integrity of my product, and willing to go to absurd lengths to ensure my client's happiness. And more often than not, the client was mollified and decided to keep the piece. But on the three or four occasions when distrustful collectors had taken me up on my offer, what the collector didn't realize was that the fake, passing from his possession to mine at a price indicative of its apparent worth, had overnight acquired a provenance. Once it was back in my hands, I had a paper trail to show it had been part of the illustrious so-and-so collection. Despite the markup I'd paid in repurchasing the fake from Mr. So-and-so, ideally an actor or a clothing designer who collected as a hobby, if not illustrious as a collector per se, I could then turn around and sell it again for sometimes twice what I'd bought it back for, to some Wall Street cheese fry who didn't know Chippendale from Ethan Allen, but was more than thrilled with official documents proving that his Duncan Fife secretary or whatever came from the collection of Mr. So-and-so, noted philanthropist, interior decorator, leading light of Broadway, fill in the blank. And so far it had worked. Only this time, Mr. So-and-so, in this case, a prize Upper East Side swish named Lucius Reeve, was not biting. What troubled me was that he seemed to think that A, he'd been taken on purpose, which was true, and B, that Hobie was in on it, was in fact the mastermind of the whole scam, which could not have been further from the truth. When I had tried to salvage the situation by insisting that the mistake was wholly mine, cough, cough, honestly, sir, misunderstanding with Hobie, I'm really quite new at this and hope you won't hold it against me. The work he does is of such a high quality, you can see how sometimes these mix-ups happen, don't you? Mr. Reeve, call me Lucius, a well-dressed figure of uncertain age and occupation, was implacable. You don't deny that the work is from James Hobart's hand, then? He'd said at our nerve-wracking lunch at the Harvard Club, leaning back slyly in his chair and running his finger around the rim of his club soda glass. Listen. It had been a tactical mistake, I realized, to meet him on his own territory where he knew the waiters, where he did the ordering with pad and pencil, where I could not be magnanimous and suggest that he try this or that.
Or that he deliberately took this carved phoenix ornament from a Thomas Affleck, from a, yes, I believe it is Affleck, Philadelphia at any rate, and affixed it to the top of this genuinely antique but otherwise undistinguished chest on chest of the same period?
Are we not speaking of the same piece?
Please, if you'd only let me... We'd been seated at a table by the window. The sun was in my eyes. I was sweating and uncomfortable.
How, then, can you maintain that the deception was not deliberate, on his part and yours?
Look, the waiter was hovering. I wanted him to leave. The mistake was mine, as I've said. And I've offered to buy the piece back at a premium, so I'm not sure what else you want me to do. But despite my cool tone, I had been in a froth of anxiety. Anxiety that had not been relieved by the fact that it was 12 days later, and Lucius Reeve still had not deposited the check that I'd given him. I'd been checking at the bank right before I ran into Platt. What Lucius Reeve wanted, I didn't know. Hobie had been making these cannibalized and heavily altered pieces, changelings as he called them, for virtually his whole working life. The storage space at Brooklyn Navy Yard had been crammed full of pieces with tags going back 30 years or more. The first time I'd gone out by myself and really poked around, I'd been thunderstruck to discover what looked like real Hepplewhite, real Sheraton, Alibaba's cave spilling with treasure.
Oh, Lord, no, said Hobie, his voice crackly on the cell phone.
The facility was like a bunker, no phone reception. I'd gone straight outside to call him, standing on the windy loading dock with one finger in my ear.
Believe me, if it was real, I'd have been on the phone to the American Furniture Department at Christie's a long time ago.
I had admired Hobie's changelings for years, and had even helped work on some of them. But it was the shock of being fooled by these previously unseen pieces that, to employ a favorite phrase of Hobie's, filled me with a wild surmise. Every so often there passed through the shop a piece of museum quality, too damaged or broken to save. For Hobie, who sorrowed over these elegant old remnants as if they were unfed children or mistreated cats, it was a point of duty to rescue what he could. A pair of finials here, a set of finely turned legs there. And then, with his gifts as carpenter and joiner, to recombine them into beautiful young Frankensteins that were in some cases plainly fanciful, but in others such faithful models of the period that they were all but indistinguishable from the real thing. Acids, paint, gold size and lampblack, wax and dirt and dust, old nails rusted with salt water, nitric acid on new walnut, drawer runners worn with sandpaper, a few weeks under the sun lamp to age new wood 100 years. From 5 destroyed Hepplewhite dining chairs, he was capable of fashioning a solid and completely authentic-looking set of 8 by taking the originals apart, copying the pieces, using wood salvaged from other damaged furniture of the period, and reassembling them with half-original and half-new parts. A chair leg, running a finger down it. Typically, they're scuffed and dented at the bottom. Even if you use old wood, you need to take a chain to the bottom of the new cut legs if you want them all to match. Very, very light. I'm not saying wail the hell out of it. Very distinctive patterning, too. Front legs usually a bit more dented than the back. See? I had seen him reconfigure original wood from a practically in splinters 18th century sideboard into a table that might have been from the hand of Duncan Fife himself.
Will it do?
Said Hobie, stepping back anxiously, not appearing to understand the marvel he had wrought. Or, as with Lucius Reeve's Chippendale chest on chest, a plain piece could in his hands become, by the addition of ornament salvaged from a grand old ruin of the same period, something practically indistinguishable from a masterwork. A more practical or less scrupulous man would have worked this skill to calculated ends and made a fortune with it. Or, in Grisha's cogent phrase,
fucked it harder than a 5 grand prostitute.
But as far as I knew, the thought of selling the changelings for originals, or indeed of selling them at all, had never crossed Hobie's mind. And his complete lack of interest in goings-on in the store gave me considerable freedom to set about the business of raising cash and taking care of bills. With a single Sheraton sofa
and a set of ribboned-back chairs I'd sold at Israel Sack prices to the trusting young California wife of an investment banker, I'd managed to pay off hundreds of thousands of back taxes on the townhouse. With another dining room set and a Sheraton settee sold to an out-of-town client who ought to have known better, but who was blinkered by Hobie and Welty's unimpeachable reputations as dealers, I'd gotten the shop out of debt.
"It's very convenient," said Lucius Reeve pleasantly, "that he leaves all the business end of the shop to you, that he has a workshop turning out these frauds, but washes his hands of how you dispose of them."
"You have my offer. I'm not going to sit here and listen to this."
"Why, then, do you continue to sit?"
I did not for one instant doubt Hobie's astonishment if he learned I was selling his changelings for real. For one thing, a lot of his more creative efforts were rife with small inaccuracies, in-jokes almost, and he was not always so fastidious about his materials as someone turning out deliberate forgeries would have been. But I had found it very easy to fool even relatively experienced buyers if I sold about 20% cheaper than the real thing. People loved to think they were getting a deal. 4 times out of 5, they would look right past what they didn't want to see. I knew how to draw people's attention to the extraordinary points of a piece, the hand-cut veneer, the fine patination, the honorable scars, drawing a finger down an exquisite cyma curve, which Hogarth himself had called the line of beauty, in order to lead the eye away from reworked bits in back, where in a strong light they might find the grain didn't precisely match. I declined to suggest that clients examine the underside of the piece, as Hobie himself, eager to educate at the price of fatally undermining his own interests, was only too quick to do. But just in case someone did want to have a look, I made sure that the floor around the piece was very, very dirty, and that the pocket light I happened to have on hand was very, very weak. There were a lot of people in New York with a lot of money and plenty of time-pressed decorators who, if you showed them a photo of a similar-looking item in an auction catalog, were happy to plump for what they saw as a discount, particularly if they were spending someone else's money. Another trick, calculated to lure a different, more sophisticated customer, was to bury a piece in the back of the store, reverse the vacuum cleaner over it, instant antiquity, and allow the nosy customer to ferret it out on his or her own. "Look, under all this dusty junk, a Sheraton settee." With this species of cheat, whom I took great pleasure in rooking, the trick was to play dumb, look bored, stay engrossed in my book, act as if I didn't know what I had, and let them think they were rooking me. Even as their hands were trembling with excitement, even as they tried to appear unhurried while rushing out to the bank for a massive cash withdrawal. If the customer was someone important or too connected to Hobie, I could always claim the piece wasn't for sale. A curt, "not for sale," was quite often the correct starting position with strangers as well, as it not only made the kind of buyer I was looking for more eager to strike a quick bargain in cash, but also set the stage for me to abort mid-deal if something went wrong. Hobie wandering upstairs at a bad moment was the main thing that might go wrong. Mrs. DeFries popping in the shop at a bad moment was another thing that could and had gone wrong. I'd had to break off just at the point of closing the sale, much to the annoyance of the movie director's wife who got tired of waiting and walked out, never to return. Short of black light or lab analysis, much of Hobie's fudging wasn't visible to the naked eye. And though he had a lot of serious collectors coming in, he also had plenty of people who would never know, for instance, that no such thing as a Queen Anne Cheval glass was ever made. But even if someone was clever enough to detect an inaccuracy, say a style of carving or a type of wood anachronistic for the maker or period, I had once or twice been bold enough to talk past even this by claiming the piece was made to order for a special customer, and hence, strictly speaking, more valuable than the usual article. In my shaky and agitated state, I turned almost unconsciously into the park and down the path to the pond, where Andy and I had sat in our parkas on many winter afternoons in elementary school, waiting for my mother to pick us up from the zoo or take us to the movies. "Rendezvous point, 1,700 hours. But at that point, unfortunately, I found myself sitting there more often than not, waiting for Jerome, the bike messenger I bought my drugs from. The pills I'd stolen from Zandra all those years before had started me on a bad road. Oxys, Roxys, morphine, and Dilaudid when I could get it. I'd been buying them off the street for years. For the past months, I'd been keeping myself, for the most part, to a one-day-on, one-day-off schedule, although what constituted an off-day was a dose just small enough to keep from getting sick. But even though it was officially an off-day, I was feeling increasingly grim, and the vodkas I'd had with Platt were wearing off, and though I knew very well that I didn't have anything on me, still I kept patting myself down, my hands stealing again and again to my overcoat and the pockets of my suit jacket. At college, I had achieved nothing commendable or remarkable. My years in Vegas had rendered me unfit for any manner of hard work, and when at last I graduated, at 21, it had taken me 6 years to finish instead of the expected 4, I did so without distinctions of any type.
"Quite honestly, I'm not seeing a lot here that's going to make a master's program take a chance on you," my counselor had said, "particularly since you would be relying so heavily on financial aid."
But that was all right. I knew what I wanted to do. My career as a dealer had started at about 17, when I happened upstairs on one of the rare afternoons Hobie had decided to open the shop. By that time, I had begun to be aware of Hobie's financial problems. Grisha had spoken only too truly about the dire consequences if Hobie continued to accumulate inventory without selling it.
"We'll still be downstairs, painting, carving, the day they come and put evacuation notice on front door."
But despite the envelopes from the IRS that had begun to accumulate among the Christie's catalogs and old concert programs on the hall table, notice of unpaid balance, reminder notice balance due, second notice balance due, Hobie couldn't be bothered to keep the store open more than half an hour at a time, unless friends happened to stop in. And when it was time for his friends to go, he often shooed out the actual customers and locked up shop. Almost invariably, I came home from school to find the closed sign on the door and people peering in at the windows. Worst of all, when he did manage to stay open for a few hours, was his habit of wandering trustfully away to make a cup of tea while leaving the door open and the register untended. Though Mike, his moving man, had had the foresight to lock the silver and jewelry cases, a number of Majolica and crystal items had walked away, and I myself had come upstairs unexpectedly on the day in question to find a gym-toned, casually dressed mom who looked like she'd just come from a Pilates class, slipping a paperweight in her bag.
"That's $850, I said, and at my voice she froze and looked up in horror.
Actually, it was only $250, but she handed me her credit card without a word and let me ring up the sale. Probably the first profitable transaction that had taken place since Welty's death. For Hobie's friends, his main customers, were only too aware that they could talk Hobie down to criminal levels on his already too low prices. Mike, who also helped in the shop on occasion, hiked up the prices indiscriminately and refused to negotiate, and in consequence sold very little at all.
"Well done,"
Hobie had said, blinking delightedly in the glare of his work lamp, when I went downstairs and informed him of my big sale. A silver teapot, in my version. I didn't want to make it seem like I'd outright robbed the woman, and besides, I knew he was uninterested in what he called the smalls, which I'd come to realize through my perusal of antiques books formed a huge part of the inventory of the store.
"Sharp-eyed little customer. Welty would have taken to you like a baby on the doorstep, taking an interest in his silver."
From then on, I'd made it a habit to sit upstairs with my schoolbooks in the afternoons while Hobie busied himself downstairs. At first it was simply for fun, fun that was sorely missing from my dreary student life, coffees in the lounge and lectures on Walter Benjamin. In the years since Welty's death, Hobart and Blackwell had evidently acquired a reputation as an easy mark for thieves, and the thrill of pouncing on these well-dressed filchers and pilferers and extorting large sums from them was almost like shoplifting in reverse.
but I also learned a lesson. A lesson which sifted down to me only by degrees, but which was, in fact, the truest thing at the heart of the business. It was the secret no one told you, the thing you had to learn for yourself, viz., that in the antiques trade, there was really no such thing as a correct price. Objective value, list value, was meaningless. If a customer came in clueless with money in hand, as most of them did, it didn't matter what the book said, what the expert said, what similar items at Christie's had recently gone for. An object, any object, was worth whatever you could get somebody to pay for it. In consequence, I'd started going through the store, removing some tags, so the customer would have to come to me for the price, and changing others. Not all, but some. The trick, as I discovered through trial and error, was to keep at least a quarter of the prices low and jack up the rest, sometimes by as much as 400 and 500%. Years of abnormally low prices had built up a base of devoted customers. Leaving a quarter of the prices low kept them devoted and ensured that people hunting for a bargain could still find one if they looked. Leaving a quarter of the prices low also meant that, by some perverse alchemy, the marked-up prices seemed legitimate in comparison. For whatever reason, some people were more apt to put out $1,500 for a Meissen teapot if it was placed next to a plainer but comparable piece selling, correctly but cheaply, for a few hundred. That was how it had started. That was how Hobart and Blackwell, after languishing for years, had begun under my beady auspices to turn a profit. But it wasn't just about money. I liked the game of it. Unlike Hobie, who assumed incorrectly that anyone who walked into his store was as fascinated by furniture as he was, who was extremely matter-of-fact in pointing out the flaws and virtues of a piece, I had discovered I possessed the opposite knack of obfuscation and mystery, the ability to talk about inferior articles in ways that made people want them. When selling a piece, talking it up, as opposed to sitting back and permitting the unwary to wander into my trap, it was a game to size up a customer and figure out the image they wanted to project. Not so much the people they were, know-it-all decorator, New Jersey housewife, self-conscious gay man, as the people they wanted to be. Even on the highest levels, it was smoke and mirrors. Everyone was furnishing a stage set. The trick was to address yourself to the projection, the fantasy self, the connoisseur, the discerning bon vivant, as opposed to the insecure person actually standing in front of you. It was better if you hung back a bit and weren't too direct. I soon learned how to dress, on the edge between conservative and flash, and how to deal with sophisticated and unsophisticated customers with differing calibrations of courtesy and indolence, presuming knowledge in both, quick to flatter, quick to lose interest or step away at exactly the right moment. And yet, with this Lucius Reeve, I had screwed up badly. What he wanted, I didn't know. In fact, he was so relentless in sidestepping my apologies and directing his anger full bore on Hobie that I was starting to think that I had stumbled into some pre-existing grudge or hatred. I didn't want to tip my hand with Hobie by bringing up Reeve's name, though who could bear such a fierce grudge against Hobie? Most well-intentioned and unworldly of persons. Apart from a few innocuous mentions in the society pages, my internet research had turned up nothing on Lucius Reeve, not even a Harvard or Harvard Club affiliation, nothing but a respectable Fifth Avenue address. He had no family that I could tell, no job or visible means of support. It had been stupid of me to write him a check. Greediness on my part. I'd been thinking about establishing a lineage for the piece, though at this point even an envelope of cash placed under a napkin and slid across the table was no assurance he was going to let the matter drop. I was standing with my fists in the pockets of my overcoat, glasses fogged from the spring damp, staring unhappily into the muddy waters of the pond, a few sad brown ducks, plastic bags washing in the reeds. Most of the benches bore the names of benefactors, in memory of Mrs. Ruth Klein or whatever. But my mother's bench, the rendezvous point,
alone of all the benches in that part of the park, had been given by its anonymous donor a more mysterious and welcoming message. Everything of possibility. It had been her bench since before I was born. In her early days in the city, she had sat there with her library book on her afternoons off, going without lunch when she needed the price of a museum pass at MoMA or a movie ticket at the Paris Theater. Further along, past the pond, where the path turned empty and dark, was the unkempt and desolate patch of ground where Andy and I had scattered her ashes. It was Andy who had talked me into sneaking over and scattering them in defiance of the city rule. Scattering them, moreover, in that particular spot.
Well, I mean, it's where she used to meet us.
Yeah, but rat poison. Look, these signs.
Go on. You can do it now. No one's coming.
She loved the sea lions, too. We always had to walk over and look at them.
Yeah, but you definitely don't want to dump her over there. It smells like fish. Besides, it creeps me out having that jar or whatever in my room.
6. My God, said Hobie when he got a good look at me under the lights. You're white as a sheet. You're not coming down with something.
He was just going out, coat over his arm. Behind him stood Mr. and Mrs. Vogel, buttoned up and smiling poisonously. My relations with the Vogels, or the Vultures, as Grisha called them, had cooled significantly since I'd taken over the shop. Mindful of the many, many pieces they'd, in my view, as good as stolen from Hobie, I now tacked on a premium to anything I even vaguely suspected they were interested in. And though Mrs. Vogel, no fool, had taken to telephoning Hobie directly, I usually managed to thwart her by, among other means, claiming to Hobie that I'd already sold the piece in question and forgotten to tag it.
Have you eaten?
Hobie, in his gentle, woolly-mindedness and unwisdom, remained completely unaware that the Vogels and I no longer held each other in anything but the very highest regard.
We're just running down the street for dinner. Come with us, why don't you?
No thanks, I said, conscious of Mrs. Vogel's gaze boring into me, cold, fraudulent smile, eyes like agate chips in her smooth, aging milkmaid face. As a rule, I took pleasure in stepping up and smiling back in her teeth, but in the stern hall lights, I felt clammy and used up, demoted somehow.
I think, I'll eat in tonight. Thanks.
Not feeling well? Said Mr. Vogel, blandly, balding Midwesterner in rimless glasses, prim in his reefer coat.
Tough luck to you if he was the banker and you were late with the mortgage. What a shame.
Lovely to see you,
Mrs. Vogel said, stepping forward and putting her plump hand on my sleeve.
Did you enjoy Pippa's visit? I wish I'd got to see her, but she was so busy with the boyfriend. What did you think of him? What was his name?
Turning back to Hobie.
Elliot?
Everett, said Hobie neutrally. Nice boy.
Yeah, I said, turning to shoulder my coat off. The appearance of Pippa, fresh off the plane from London with this Everett, had been one of the uglier shocks of my life. Counting the days, the hours, shaky from sleeplessness and excitement, unable to stop myself looking at my watch every 5 minutes, leaping at the doorbell, and literally running to throw open the door. And there she stood, hand in hand with this shoddy Englishman.
And what does he do? A musician, too?
Music librarian, actually, said Hobie.
We don't know what that entails nowadays with computers and all.
Oh, I'm sure Theo knows all about it,
said Mrs. Vogel.
No, not really. Cy-brarian,
said Mr. Vogel, with an uncharacteristically loud and merry chuckle. Addressing me,
is it true what they say? That young people today can make it through school without once setting foot in a library?
I wouldn't know.
A music librarian? It had taken every ounce of possession I had to keep my face empty, guts crumbling, end of everything, to accept his moist English hand.
Hello, Everett. You must be Theo. Heard so much about you, blah, 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 while I stood frozen in the doorway like a bayoneted Yank staring at the stranger who'd run me through to death. He was a slight, wide-eyed bounce of a guy, innocent, bland, infuriatingly cheerful, dressed in jeans and hoodie like a teenager, and his quick, apologetic smile when we were alone in the living room had sent me blank with rage. Every moment of their visit had been torture. Somehow I'd stumbled through it, though I'd tried to stay away from them as much as I could. As skilled a dissembler as I was, I could barely be civil to him. Everything about him, his pinkish skin, his nervous laugh, the hair sprouting out the cuffs of his shirt sleeves, made me want to jump on him and knock his horsey English teeth out. And wouldn't that be a surprise, I thought grimly, glaring at him across the table. If old antique-dealing Specs hauled off and busted his eggs for him. Still, as hard as I'd tried, I hadn't been able to stay away from Pippa. I'd hovered obtrusively and hated myself for it. So painfully excited had I been by her nearness, her bare feet at breakfast, bare legs, her voice, unexpected glimpse of her white armpits when she pulled her sweater over her head, the agony of her hand on my sleeve.
Hi, lovey. Hi, darling.
Coming up behind me, cupping my eyes with her hands.
Surprise!
She wanted to know everything about me, everything I was doing, wedging in beside me on the Queen Anne love seat so that our legs touched. Oh, God. What was I reading? Could she look at my iPod? Where did I get that fantastic wristwatch? Whenever she smiled at me, heaven blew in. And yet every time I devised some pretext to get her on her own, here he came, thump, 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 sheepish grin, arm around her shoulder, wrecking everything. Conversation in the next room, a burst of laughter. Are the two of them talking about me? Putting his hands on her waist, calling her Pips. The only even vaguely tolerable or amusing moment of his visit was when Popchick, territorial in his old age, had jumped up unprovoked and bitten him on the thumb. Oh, God! Hobie rushing for the alcohol, Pippa fretting, Everett trying to be cool but visibly put out.
Sure, dogs are great. I love them. We just never had them because my mom's allergic.
He was the poor relation, his phrase, of an old schoolmate of hers, American mother, numerous siblings, father who taught some incomprehensible mathematical, philosophical something or other at Cambridge. Like her, he was a vegetarian, verging on vegan. To my dismay, it had emerged that the two of them were sharing a flat. He had, of course, slept in her room during the visit, and for 5 nights, the whole time he was there, I'd lain awake bilious with fury and sorrow, ears attuned to every rustle of bedclothes, every sigh and whisper from next door. And yet, waving goodbye to Hobie and the Vogels, have a great time, and turning grimly away, what could I have expected? It had enraged me, cut me to the bone, the careful, kindly tone she had taken with me around this Everett.
No,
I said politely, when she asked me whether I was seeing someone.
Not really.
Although, I was proud of it in a lucid, gloomy way. I was, in fact, sleeping with two different girls, neither of whom knew about the other. One of them had a boyfriend in another town, and the other had a fiancé whom she was tired of, whose calls she screened when we were in bed together. Both of them were pretty, and the girl with the cuckolded fiancé was downright beautiful, a baby Carol Lombard. But neither of them were real for me. They were only stand-ins for her. I was irritated at how I felt. To sit around heartbroken, the first word, unfortunately, that came to mind, was foolish. It was maudlin and contemptible and weak.
Oh, boo-hoo. She's in London. She's with someone else.
Go pick up some wine and fuck Carol Lombard. Get over it. But the thought of her gave me such continual anguish that I could no more forget her than an aching tooth. It was involuntary, hopeless, compulsive. For years she had been the first thing I remembered when I woke up, the last thing that drifted through my mind as I went to sleep. And during the day she came to me obtrusively, obsessively, always with a painful shock. What time was it in London? Always adding and subtracting, totting up the time difference, compulsively checking the London weather on my phone. 53 degrees Fahrenheit, 10:12 p.m. and light precipitation. Standing on the corner of Greenwich and 7th Avenue by boarded-up St. Vincent's, heading downtown to meet my dealer. And what about Pippa? Where was she? In the back of a taxi cab, out at dinner, drinking with people I didn't know, asleep in a bed I'd never seen. I desperately wanted to see photos of her flat in order to add some much-needed detail to my fantasies, but was too embarrassed to ask. With a pang, I thought of her bedsheets, what they must be like, a dark dorm room color as I imagined them, tumbled, unwashed, a student's dark nest, her freckled cheek pale against a maroon or purple pillowcase, English rain tapping against her window, her photographs lining the hall outside my bedroom, many different Pippas at many different ages, were a daily torment, always unexpected, always new. But though I tried to keep my eyes away, always it seemed I was glancing up by mistake, and there she was, laughing at somebody else's joke, or smiling at someone who wasn't me. Always a fresh pain, a blow straight to the heart. And the strange thing was, I knew that most people didn't see her as I did. If anything, found her a bit odd-looking with her off-kilter walk and her spooky redhead pallor. For whatever dumb reason, I had always flattered myself that I was the only person in the world who really appreciated her, that she would be shocked and touched and maybe even come to view herself in a whole new light if she knew just how beautiful I found her. But this had never happened. Angrily, I concentrated on her flaws, willfully studying the photographs that caught her at awkward ages and less flattering angles, long nose, thin cheeks, her eyes, despite their heartbreaking color, naked-looking with their pale lashes, Huck Finn plain. Yet all these aspects were, to me, so tender and particular, they moved me to despair. With a beautiful girl, I could have consoled myself that she was out of my league, that I was so haunted and stirred even by her plainness suggested, ominously, a love more binding than physical affection. Some tar pit of the soul, where I might flop around and malinger for years. For in the deepest, most unshakable part of myself, reason was useless. She was the missing kingdom, the unbruised part of myself I'd lost with my mother. Everything about her was a snowstorm of fascination, from the antique valentines and embroidered Chinese coats she collected, to her tiny, scented bottles from Neil's Yard Remedies. There had always been something bright and magical about her unknown, faraway life. Vaux, Suisse, 23 Rue de Tombouctou, Blenheim Crescent, CR2, 6BN. Furnished rooms in countries I had never seen. Clearly this Everett, poor as a church mouse, his phrase, was living off her money. Uncle Welty's money, rather. Old Europe preying off young America, to use a phrase I'd employed in my Henry James paper in my last semester of school. Could I write him a check to make him leave her alone? Alone in the shop, in the slow, cool afternoons, the thought had crossed my mind. 50,000 if you walk out tonight, 100 if you never see her again. Money was a concern with him, clearly. During his visit, he'd always been digging anxiously in his pockets, constant stops at the cash machine, taking out 20 bucks at a time. Good God. It was hopeless. There was simply no way in hell she could matter half as much to Mr. Music Library as she did to me. We belonged together. There was a dream rightness and magic to it, inarguable. The thought of her flooded every corner of my mind with light, and poured brightness into miraculous lofts I hadn't even known were there, vistas that seemed to exist not at all except in relationship to her. Over and over I played her favorite Ervo Pärt as a way of being with her, and she had only to mention a recently read novel for me to grab it up hungrily, to be inside her thoughts, a sort of telepathy. Certain objects that passed through the shop, a Pleyel piano, a strange little scratched-up Russian cameo,